in sports radio, the paradigm that we've really had, it's white guys talking about black guys, and you can't really talk about the black guys the same way when it's a black dude leading the conversation. If you are black and not anti-establishment, then you are in a lot of ways defeating yourself.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we go behind the scenes with people in the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week, our guest is the ESPN commentator, Bomani Jones. Bomani Jones is on a number of platforms at ESPN, including television, where he's one of the co-hosts of the highly questionable show with Dan Le Batard and Dan Le Batard's dad, as well as the host of The Right Time with Bomani Jones on ESPN Radio. And he joins us now from Miami, Florida. Here is Bomani Jones. Bomani, thank you very much for being guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
No, man, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. I've been looking forward to this. All right. Got a lot to cover, Bomani, with you. Spent last night. You have a really interesting family, by the way, so we'll get into that as well. But first off, how do you go about preparing for highly questionable on a daily basis?
I try to just be on top of as many things as possible, and then when it's time to talk, they all find a way to come together.
When you're saying you try to stay on top of as many things as possible, how do you go about doing that? Is the first thing in the morning you wake up, you hit the web, you're reading different sites? Obviously, I know you're very active on Twitter. You're checking out different writers. What's your process in terms of being prepared?
Well, what I've done is I've basically engineered my Twitter feed into being the thing that prepares me. So I follow something like 4,000 people or something like that. But you can put together a collection of people in such a way where I've got people I trust in what they recommend to read or things that I go ahead and read. Like, I think that part of the 21st century of the Internet is that personal recommendation in the social media era matters a lot more than a lot of these other things. Like, the nature of search has changed. So having people recommend things to you is very, very important. So I have those sorts of things. Just kind of get a handle on what other arguments, just like regular people that nobody really pays attention to, are saying, what the jokes that are going on about right then. But you can engineer your Twitter page in such a way that it'll keep you on top of everything you need to for a job like I have.
All right. So you've done Highly Questionable. And now the radio show obviously is happening later that night at 9 o'clock. Some of the preparation obviously must be the same in terms of just sort of getting a sense of how to stay current for the day. But specific to radio, what else are you doing to prepare for your show on ESPN Radio?
Well, radio's different because it's one thing when you only got to talk about something for a minute and a half. It's another when you got to try to talk about something for 11 minutes straight. So, like, the topics that work on television are not necessarily the topics that are going to wind up working on radio. So what I try to do is, and in my head, and I'm trying to get better about writing stuff down because I'm not really good about note-taking and the likes, especially for a time like this in July, I am trying my best to keep up with as many things that are just kind of evergreen as possible, just like topics that you can throw in there on any given day, and then you can rock with it. Okay, cool. Like, you want to have those kind of in your back pocket. But what I would ideally like to do with the radio show, like, the radio show right now is just 2 hours. I feel like if I have 3 truly compelling topics, I could get through a 3-hour radio show and maybe throw a guest or two in there, because there are enough different angles and approaches that you can have in talking about it. Like, if there's one story that's like dominating the news day, I'm not the type that has a problem with doing a whole radio show about it. If there are enough angles to where when we keep coming back, we can talk about it in a different way and it's something that nobody's heard before. You don't really get that many topics that are necessarily like that, though. So if I can go in the day and I can find 2 really meaty sort of topics between me and callers, that'll kill pretty much. Like, 2 really meaty topics with some callers will kill about an hour of a radio show. And it'll be legitimately compelling radio for the people who are listening.
You mentioned the time element in terms of how much time you have on Highly Questionable in a segment versus how much time you'll have on the radio show. Do you prefer one medium to the other? And if so, why?
Oh, yeah, I like radio more than I like anything else. Television is so sterile. Like, our television show is a bit freewheeling, and it allows more room for people to have fun. But, like, if you're ever in a control room when people are doing TV, man, they're so uptight because the stakes are so high. The money is so much, and seconds are so valuable in television. In radio, it's not the same. It's a lot looser. It's a different personality type that you find that is attracted to that business and that then wants to work in that business. And then on radio, at least with the dynamic that I have right now, I love Dan and Poppy to death, but I sure love being able to talk without having to worry about anybody else trying to get in there.
In terms of producers, how many producers you have for HQ? How many producers you have for the radio show?
Oh, man, for HQ, I'm not sure I could give you a number necessarily. Like, we've got Matt Kelleher and Eric Rideholm, the two guys that we deal with, the executive producers, directly kind of when we're doing the show. Then we've got, you know, different people producing different blocks. Like, I'd probably say, if I had to count, because I don't really know job titles that well, and all those guys are in D.C., I guess it's probably about 8 or 9 people that maybe we would count as being producers, you know, knock on wood that I got that correct. And then on radio, as of right now, I've got my guy Stas Sienke. He produces the show and runs the board, and we got a board op. But those guys are in Bristol, and I'm in Miami. So the Miami, the radio show as it is right now, we're working to get a gentleman named Shannon Penn, who produced my radio show for me when I worked in Raleigh. He'll be on board to produce the 9 to 11 show pretty soon. But as of right now, we're doing radio in a pretty simple sort of format.
You, you're part of a number of ensemble shows, including HQ, Around the Horn. Obviously on radio, you're a solo act. But in terms of the ensemble stuff, how much do you have to like your colleagues to have a good show?
That's debatable. It kind of depends on what kind of show you're going to have, right? So I think that you could make a pretty compelling television show on the days that me and Woody Page might not necessarily like each other that much. Now, the reason that you could probably do that is that we're not in the same place. And that's not to say that I don't like Woody, but just throw that out as an example. When you do something like an ensemble show, it really helps if you like each other. But if you don't, like if I'm having a bad day dealing with Dan for whatever reason, you'll never see it on television. Like that, just that kind of thing just doesn't come up for me in that, because my thing is, okay, let's get in, let's get this job done, and then we go on about our business. I find for a lot of people that sort of thing is very difficult. But for Around the Horn, I don't really have much of a counterfactual, because I've really come to like pretty much everybody that's on that show.
So why does that work? Let's say you're having a bad day, or Levitard's having a bad day. Why are you able to put any kind of personal feelings aside and be able to do the show as you would if things were cotton candy and sunshine?
I can't speak for Dan on that, but I can say for me, they pay me to come do this show. Right? Like, if it's time to come do the show, you come and do the show. Like, it's going to be very difficult for me to walk in and be upset about this fact. Oh, my goodness, I have to come in here and make this exorbitant sum of money, and I'm sitting next to somebody I'm not so happy with today. You know, like, that's really not the biggest thing in the world. Like, we get in, we're not in there very long doing the show. So if one of those days were to come or something like that, for me, that's not a big deal. I think that a big part of being an adult is recognizing that how you feel isn't that big of a deal.
It's a good answer, and it's a really good answer when it comes to the sports media, where there are certainly a lot of complaints for salaries and jobs, which are really well paid and incredibly fun. All right, Bomani, let's cut right to the meat. There is an opening at ESPN Radio between 10 and 1 now that Colin Cowherd has or will be soon departing ESPN. He is heading for Fox, as many people have reported, including myself. That makes that slot theoretically open. How would you classify your interest in Colin Cowherd's radio spot?
The way that I would say that is that I believe that the 10-to-1 radio show on ESPN Radio is analogous to the University of Texas football job for coaches. It's the best job out there. Like, it is the single best job that is available. And it's really the best job if you really enjoy doing radio, like the art of doing radio and getting in and doing segments and doing talkers and having the room to kind of stretch out. Like, the audience that you have at middays is an audience that is, like, I feel like a morning show is a bit more of a utility, right? Like, people come to a morning show for certain things. Those are the morning show breaks. Are going to be full of traffic updates. They're going to be full of with weather and everything else, because people need that as a device, basically. You know, it kind of sets them up for their day. A midday radio show is to be enjoyed more than it is simply to be listened to. So if you really, really enjoy doing radio, if you really like putting together segments, if you really like building relationships with callers and listeners, you're going to have a more intimate relationship with all parties involved from 10 to 1. And then you're going to have great distribution doing that show on ESPN Radio from 10 to 1. So I don't think there's anybody who wouldn't want that job.
All right, that's interesting. And there's a couple things that are offshoots of that to me, because I don't think I've heard anybody say that. Traditionally in radio, whether you think of people like Howard Stern and others, at your place, Mike and Mike, morning drive is the place that they make a ton of money and that they want their quote-unquote stars there. In certain cities, one I live in New York, Drive Time is the absolute spot. A guy named Mike Francesa has pretty much owned sports talk in New York for a long time. In Drive Time, you go to some other cities, including Miami, where Lebertard is the king of Drive Time. That is, they put their people there. So that's interesting to me that you would say that, that you would think the 10 to, that you wouldn't take the morning spot or the Drive Time spot, because you figure that's where, at least as talent, the bigger money would be, no?
Yeah, there's something certainly to that. Now, I don't know. I don't really have a great idea of how the money works at ESPN Radio necessarily with Afternoon Drive versus the midday show. But I think the midday show is probably a more lucrative situation at that particular place. But the thing I would say about that is what you're saying is correct. But most of the things about money and the likes, and let's be clear, perhaps I can view it differently sitting where I am right now because I have a television job that pays, right? So maybe I can just be like, oh, well, the money. Well, yeah, the money that you get a lot of times in Afternoon Drive is better. And I think if you're doing a local show, perhaps Afternoon Drive is a little bit better of a situation. With a national show, like just for the way that I enjoy doing radio and the things that I like, the way that I like to go about it, the things that I like to talk about, I would much rather have a radio show that is formatted and imaged strictly to be a radio show than an afternoon or morning drive show, which is really formatted to be a utility. Like it serves a role in people's lives that is a bit more functional. And I'm not especially artistic about my work necessarily, but if you want to be an artist about doing radio, I think midday is the place to go. Jim Rome has, you know, set the world on fire. He's done that from 12 to 3. We move out of sports. Rush Limbaugh has done this from 12 to 3. Like when you talk about those really big time guys in national radio, we're talking about Colin, for example. Colin did this from 10 to 1. Those really big time guys have done that from 10 to 1. Like wherever that 10 to 1 spot goes for ESPN, it's going to be fantastic for whoever the person is who gets it, because you're going to have resources, you're going to have reach, you're going to have an ability because of the name and the show that you've got to get all the guests that you could possibly dream of. I mean, there are a lot of things there for that 10 to 1 spot. So whoever winds up being the person who gets it is going to wind up in a fantastic situation.
And that's a good point with Limbaugh and Rome, for sure. Have you spoken to management about the fact that you would, quite frankly, be interested in that slot?
I have made that clear. I think that I brought that up to them when I first started doing this job, because there's a possibility that it would be there. But to be fair, I don't think that there's a single person at that operation. I'm sure there's somebody at ESPN pushing a mop who wouldn't mind doing that 10 to 1 show.
What? That's funny. What have they shared with you in terms of where their direction is likely headed for that slot?
I have personally not been told anything particular. Like my agent talked to him and, you know, we've kind of gone back and forth on some of the things they were talking about. The last time I got anything definite from anybody, they were still just kind of working out and figuring out what the decision was that they were ultimately going to make. Like, I don't think that they can, I really think that if they go in-house, I don't think that they're in a position to lose. If they decide to go outside, they have the ability to get a very talented person, and I don't think that they are really in a position to lose. So for them, I think that they have one of those somewhat difficult decisions, which is how do you pick between all of these good options? And I think that they're in a situation where they have a lot of good options they can choose from.
All right, listen, this is a hypothetical, but also something I reported that as of now, the, you know, quote unquote leader in the clubhouse, the person most likely to get the spot would be Dan Lebertard, at least in terms of what management is thinking. What Dan Lebertard is thinking might be something different. He's got a great setup with Drive Time in Miami. Highly questionable, as you know better than anybody, tapes at 12:30. That fits right into the 10 to 1 spot. I'm sure Dan doesn't want to screw with that show. I know he loves working with his father. So hypothetically, Bomani, let's say someone in-house, whether it's Dan or someone like that, and it's not you, gets the 10 to 1 spot. Would you then expect your show from 9 to 11 to then move to an earlier day part?
I think it would certainly be possible. From what I can tell, and I haven't gotten a great deal of metrics on the show, I have received like a small hint of some digital numbers, but that was months ago. From what I can tell, the show that I'm doing is doing pretty well. It's doing pretty well, and we are not yet operating at full capacity in terms of the things that I'd like to do and some of the personnel to be in place. We haven't even gotten there yet, but the show so far, from what I can tell, is doing well, and from what I can tell, the people in charge seem to be pretty happy with it. So if they would consider me for the 10-to-1 show, and they did, I would assume that they would have a consideration for me on the 4-to-7 show. I think it would be a matter for all parties involved in making sure that that would be like the best thing for everybody. But I would not go so far as to say that I expected them to move my show from 4-to-7. Because quite honestly, I've been working in this media game, I guess, now for about 15 years, and I've learned better than to expect anything. That's just not how it goes.
Do you think a national evening show is a tough sell in local markets where, you know, first of all, sometimes in local markets, there's games obviously going on at night, so you may be preempted or you may be going up against the local team. But then secondly, how do you think a national sports talk show plays between 9 and 12, let's say, against a local sports show, which is specifically only talking about local teams?
Well, you're talking about 9 to 12 at night, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about where you are right now, basically.
Well, that's an interesting one. Now, for summer, for example, the local that you're going to go against that might be going on at the same time or might preempt you will be baseball. And there are basically two kinds of sports fans, people who love baseball and people who don't give a damn about baseball. Like, you're going to get the people who don't give a damn about baseball. And the counter-programming against something like that in the summer is you're probably not going to talk about nearly as much baseball because baseball is probably an option on the dial somewhere for those people. I honestly think that the way I approach all those things, no matter what, is that if you're going to preempt me in your local market for the baseball game, that's fine. I can't do anything about that. If you have a baseball game on at the same time on another station as I'm on, my job is to be more entertaining than a baseball game on the radio. No disrespect to baseball, but I feel like that's something I can pull off.
Poor Rob Manfred. Bomani, when you are thinking of your audience, do you have a specific archetype in mind? When you close your eyes and think of the people who are listening to you, do they look like something, somebody? Are they a certain age? Are they a certain race? Are they a certain gender?
They look like they're on their way to work or on the way home from work. That's pretty much it. I have always, I think perhaps the biggest influence to the way that I've tried to put together radio shows and image them has been Tom Joyner. And I've always found about the Tom Joyner Morning Show, the common bond really there, like you can talk about blackness because it's certainly, you know, black is what they're going for. That's the market. There's no question. But then within black, how does that work? And I always find that the way that that works is the common bond that binds most of us all is the fact that we have to go to work. When we talk about sports, we're talking about people who are going to work. It's various interpretations that people have about the way that you should handle yourself when you go to work, how your boss handles you and everything else. That's something that we all can kind of understand. So like when I see my audience, I learned in Raleigh very, very quickly that the audience that I was able to attract was probably broader than anybody would have given it credit for being. When you hear the people who call the show that we got right now, it's going to be a broader audience than I think that most people would expect. So, like, I think that the type of radio that I do is the type that can attract just about anyone because I've been around enough parts of life and enough walks of it that I feel like it's something I have in common with just about everybody who happens to be listening to the show. The most difficult thing often when you're doing radio, especially as a black dude doing radio, is convincing the PDs or anybody else that you're not going to scare the white folks. That's a huge thing, and I have no fear of that, and it normally takes a while for people in charge to recognize that, but the audience that I attract, I think, is a decidedly American audience.
That's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's really interesting to me. So you are a 30-something black guy. Do you think your previous employers have always just made the assumption that your audience is only 20 to 30-year-old listeners of color?
I think that the assumption that I've had, because I worked at one local station and I worked at a satellite station, and the satellite station is based out of Canada. I found that they were a little more open in their expectations of what the show would ultimately turn into. When I was working locally, it's hard for me to know exactly what it is that they thought or like exactly what their concerns were. I do know, though, that there was a bit of a surprise when that show started to, when it began to prove itself to be successful and we started to get numbers that indicated that it had really, really like started to come up. I know that I had problems in the beginning with, for example, bump music. Right? These are things that happen when you're black and you're in this. So in the beginning at that station, stationality was a big deal and they wanted everybody to kind of run music that was kind of off the same set of CDs. And I asked them, okay, so what do you want me to do? And the guy said, what do you mean? And I was like, okay, I understand where you guys are coming from with this music, but like what you want to play wouldn't make sense with me then coming behind. Like, it's not fitting the personality of my show. But the decision had kind of been made that they had a way that they wanted the station to sound, and the way they wanted that station to sound wasn't black, like, at all. Like, that wasn't really the goal that they were going for in stationality, because programming directors in radio generally are trying to attract a certain affluent white man between the ages of 25 and 54. They don't explicitly say that they're going after that white man, but you can listen to the station and it's pretty clear that's who the audience is that they're going after. And I think that a lot of people who work in radio have a level of apprehension about how well that white man somewhere between 25 and 54 is going to be able to relate to the black dude.
That's interesting. Bet, I don't think we have bump music on this show, so we're in good shape. Maybe we get hee-haw or something if we want to appeal to the southern white crowd. Bomani, that brings up an interesting question to me. And you are, I think you'll have an interesting answer on this. And I don't honestly know the answer to this, but do you think sports fans care about the race or ethnicity of the host? And this is prior to them liking the host. So at a certain point, I think you like a voice, you like someone's thought, you like someone's opinion, and I'd like to think you sort of become colorblind to that. But prior to that, do you think race and ethnicity matters to the sports fan, regardless of the geography of where they're listening?
Yes. If you go to a website for a radio station the day after they, or the day that they announce that they hired some black dude who is not an athlete to work a show, go look at the comments. It matters. It comes up a lot. When I first started working in Raleigh, they had to start really monitoring the comments on the blog a lot closer than they had before, because that's what was coming up. It'd come up repeatedly. The way the caller, I've had callers call in and say things that you wouldn't believe. I had a guy call in the show last night and I was talking about Hoosiers and say the reason he liked Hoosiers was because he, it was about a time before the black Africans, these are quotes, by the way,
I heard the show last night.
Yeah, and then he said something about the color. It's like, no. These things matter because talk radio is a lifestyle thing. Like, people are coming to talk about sports, that's fine, but it's a lifestyle thing. Like, the reason Dan's show could be so successful is not really about show. It's about a certain lifestyle that goes along with it. And sports radio, the paradigm that we've really had really has been it's white guys talking about black guys. And you can't really talk about the black guys the same way when it's a black dude leading the conversation.
That's true. I mean, that's pretty much the paradigm for sports radio, generally speaking. We can get into a long conversation about the lack of gender in sports talk, but it's generally speaking been white men of a certain age, 30 to 50, talking about black men of a certain age, 20 to 40.
Yes, it's the same thing. Now, with gender, for example, they care very much about whether or not it is a man or a woman hosting a show. Like, I feel like if a woman can stay the course, she can be very, very successful, because there's so many men who kind of get off on, for lack of a better term, phallic type things. So the idea of a woman doing sports talk radio, which to them is something that a man can do, like once a man is supposed to do, like once they get past the early part, I think that you can find that people can come around to it. I think they come around on the black guys host way more than programming directors would have you believe. But I do think whether people are conscious of the fact or not, the paradigm has been so strongly established that it's a white man talking about these sports that it takes a lot for people to see a black dude or a woman doing what they think is a white man's job.
That's interesting, because then what immediately comes to mind after you say that would be just how much respect and how much shit Jemele Hill had to overcome to get to her position of prominence as a national African-American woman being an opinionist on sports.
She deals with more than I think that anybody can really get a grasp on. Like, people send me crazy stuff and I send it out to people so that we can laugh about it, because I think it's kind of hilarious how caught up people get, in these emotions of strangers and everything else. But what I am asked to put up with as a man, no matter what kind of man I happen to be, absolutely pales in comparison to the kinds of things that she has to put up with, the Beatle gets, like, up and down the list. People may hate the fact that I exist, but they at least acknowledge the fact that I have some business or have some acumen talking about sports by virtue of this penis. Women, they can't win. They absolutely can't win. And there's so many men who get really, really, really into sports because they're kind of disenfranchised in their own lives. And they place an importance on the sports that is unnecessary, I think, based upon the lives that they live. And then they look up and there's this woman talking about sports and, God forbid, making money for it. Woo!
And I believe that is the first reference of the word penis on this podcast. Took us 12 episodes, so that's fantastic. Thank you, Bamani.
Hey, man, I'm a pioneer, man.
You're here for us. I want to ask you about your family. This is interesting to me. I'll educate some people here who listen to this podcast who don't know this. On June 24th, 1960, Barbara Posey addressed the 51st annual NAACP convention in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That came on the day after she turned 17. 17-year-old addressing the NAACP convention in 1960. Barbara Posey also organized what is believed to be the earliest student sit-in in history as the president of the local NAACP Youth Council in Oklahoma City. I read Barbara Posey's speech last night to the NAACP convention. Barbara Posey is your mother. Is that correct, Bamani Jones?
Yes, she is.
Your father, Mac Jones, earned his PhD in political science from the University of Illinois, was a longtime political scientist at Clark, taught there, I think, as well. Your mom holds a master's in economics from Illinois, a PhD in economics from Georgia State, spent the better part of her career at Clark University, also was a dean in the School of Business at Alabama A&M. Your sister is a best-selling noted author. I think she's a professor, too. Your brother's a professional doing something either in advertising or marketing, another obviously smart guy. You have a very, very, very educated and smart and pioneering family. This leads me to ask, how much sports was being talked about in your household growing up as opposed to politics, social issues, and economics?
Oh, plenty of sports. Like, that's the thing, is that, like, I think people hear about, like, the things that my parents do for a living and kind of have a picture of an erudite academic household that is not wrong necessarily, but not quite in line. Like, I think our family and hanging out and sports stuff, like, sports are always there. Like, me and my dad watching baseball from when I was 6 years old on. That's our thing. My dad watches all the shows. He's retired now. He watches all the shows that I'm on, and we talk about all those things. And my mother's into sports in that way also. My brother's a pretty good basketball player. My sister doesn't care about any of that stuff. But, like, this, you know, I think in those ways, talking about sports in the house for me was really no different than it would be for most people, just being there talking about sports. It just so happened my old man and my mom had PhDs.
You know, I mean, I realize you lived with them, you love them, they are part of your life, but could you for a second just sort of step back and offer just your thoughts on the fact that what your mother did when she was only 17 years old in a time of civil rights strife? I mean, she was clearly a pretty remarkable kid doing what she was doing at the age of 17.
Yeah, no, my mother graduated from the University of Oklahoma in 1963, which you stop and think about that for a second, wow, given what the times had to have been. She did that. My father, he started his undergrad at Southern University in Baton Rouge. He eventually got an honorary degree from Baton Rouge, and they had to give him an honorary one because they kicked him out for participating in sit-ins in Baton Rouge at that time, where the order was made by the governor that all the students involved in the sit-ins had to be put out of school. That's who they are. And what I think is perhaps most interesting about them, and to a degree, it's admirable to a degree, and on the other hand, I kind of wish they hadn't done it, is that they don't talk that much about it. Like, there's not that much of a self-aggrandizement from them on, like, the accomplishments that they've had. With my mother, for example, like, those sit-ins that she was in Oklahoma City, that predates Greensboro, for example. Like, wow, that predates what was going on there. And Greensboro is the one that we talk about historically as being the one. Like, the sit-ins that we talk about with relationship to my mother are probably most famous nationally, because Kanye West talks about his mother going to the sit-ins when she was 6 years old. Those are the same ones. Like, that's the same thing. That's probably where most people know about that. And my mom has a remarkable level of modesty about all of those things. I don't know how much of that is that she came up as a woman in an era where we encourage women even more so than we do right now to, like, not want to threaten a man or to fall back from it or those sorts of things. But I learned probably in my late teens and early 20s, kind of specific to my family, that I won the lottery in terms of parents because they're just wonderful people. But also, it wasn't until then that I really got a grasp on the magnitude of the work that both of them had done. Like, my father retired for the first time in, I think, 2002, and I started going to the events around his retirement. And I just really did not have a proper grasp on the level of influence that he'd had. He's probably as influential as any black political scientist has been in the United States. And then my mom always thought about in the context of her being the dean of business and just the relationship that she had with students and the way the students looked up to her and the way that they revered her. Like, I always appreciated that. But the things that came before, I have to admit that I didn't really have a great handle on the importance of those things until I got to be a bit older. Like, my brother and I talk about this all the time, that as far as this parent thing go, we really, really won.
Did they always encourage you to foster your love of sports, or did they, I should just ask you that. How did they see your love of sports growing up?
Well, you know, growing up, it was a lot of watching baseball. It was like, smart kids, baseball is the greatest thing in the world, right? A bunch of numbers for you to memorize and to show off that you know, right? That's why so many baseball fans, like baseball fanatics now, are so damn insufferable. They're the kids who kept on doing that for the rest of their lives. But like, that's like, baseball was always the thing. That's the big one for me growing up, not so much as an adult. But that was always the one. And I wouldn't say they pushed it necessarily, but they didn't push against it. Like, my parents kind of just let me roll into whatever it was I did or did not want to do at a given point in time. That's always been them. Even as I got to be a young adult and that was getting to be a little bit dicey under where it ultimately was going to wind up. But they've never, even when it got to the point where I decided, okay, I think I'm going to try to do this for a living, they figured that I'd find a way if a way was to be found. So they've always been with it. They've always been incredibly supportive of whatever it was that I happened to be doing.
You have a master's degree in economics from Claremont Graduate University. You also have one from University of North Carolina, correct?
Yes.
Do you recommend young sportscasters getting two masters in economics as a way to get into the business?
Well, I'd be careful about that part. The second master's in economics is the one they give you when you flunk out of school. It's quite a consolation prize, a parting gift, that second one. The one thing I would say, though, I don't know if I necessarily recommend getting two master's degrees, but I definitely recommend if you were in school to major in something other than journalism. I think that it is much more important for you to have a thought process and outlook on the world than it is to learn those the technical things that you need to know about being a journalist. You can figure those things out on the road. So many of these great journalists that we all revere do not have journalism degrees. Like Bob Ryan, of course, is a guy that jumps to mind immediately. He has an English degree, but then you go in, you work at a paper in school, or maybe you get your early job, and then you learn how to do it, and you go from there. I feel like the comparative advantage that I have for the type of work that I do that allows me to talk about a broad number of things without having a lot of experience, like actually covering them, is that I'm approaching them with a thought process, and the thought process kind of goes all across. So there are a lot of guys, you know, the guys who have been covering games for forever and ever, they've been in locker rooms, they're so much better at those things like gathering information than I am. And they understand how to weed somebody out and tell them the truth in ways that I would never be able to. The advantage that I have is that I got a way to look at the world and take the information that they provide and then put it into a different context. But there's room for people to be able to do both of those things. So I feel like if you really want to be a journalist, majoring in journalism is almost limiting how good your journalism will be.
Dan Le Batard told the Atlanta Voice that you are an anti-establishment guy inside the establishment being ESPN. Do you agree with that assessment?
I think there's something to be said for that. I think that's the best way to put this. The status quo, like pretty much no matter where you are, the status quo is not set up to do good things for somebody like me. That's just kind of how this works. The status quo, when you're the black dude, if you are black and not anti-establishment, then you are in a lot of ways defeating yourself. That's kind of the way that I've always seen that. Like, I'm not in here necessarily trying to burn the whole damn thing down or anything like that, but I am able to do good work within the structure that I'm in, certainly. But the way the world is not necessarily a world that I like. And there are things that I have a problem with. I certainly do the best I can to bring attention to them if I think that they're important, and then kind of go from there. So I think that's probably a fair way to put that.
Is it, and I don't ask this with any being pejorative at all, but is it an oxymoron for anyone who's anti-establishment to be working for the most establishment sports brand in the world?
You know, that's a fair question. There's something to be said for that. Well, here's the thing. There's nowhere that you are going to be able to truly exist and have anybody hear you without having a relationship with the establishment. It's just not possible. So the question then becomes, if you want to be heard, do you have to become part of the establishment? And in some way, I think the answer to that is probably yes. Now, do you have to sell out to the establishment in order to do that? The answer to that, I like to think at the very least, is no. But I think that within the machine we're in, I think it gets lost kind of the leeway that people have in your ability to talk about things. Like, I think when stuff came up with Simmons, and Simmons would have his back and forth with the suits at ESPN, on the other end of that with Simmons would come this thing where they're not letting Simmons say what he wants to say. And there may have been something to that, but I don't really have very meek opinions, and I've never been in a situation where I felt like ESPN was going to stop me from saying something that I wanted to say at any point. And I say things that are critical of leagues. I say things that are critical of important people, and it's allowed to take place on their airways. So I do think that there's room for it. Now, the question is, how anti-establishment can you get before somebody calls you up and it's like, hey, man, just, you know, you want to take a look easier on the establishment, please?
And that's a great segue to lead into Twitter. Both of us are very, very active on Twitter. Both of us have had our share of public conversations with other people in the media on Twitter. Let me ask, I think your Twitter feed is really, really interesting, so I have a number of questions off this. First off, in talking about other ESPN colleagues for you, you've been critical, and I would say, by the way, rightly, of Colin Coward's John Wall comments. You've gotten into some back and forth with colleagues on serious topics. Probably the most recently, you and Chris Broussard talking about premarital sex and chastity and where that sort of should align. Have you ever heard from management at all about your Twitter feed in specifically relating to interactions with other ESPN colleagues?
Not really. My agent happened to be on the phone with someone when the Broussard thing was happening. Because the thing about the Broussard thing as it happened was I was almost late to it. Like, Chris sent me that, and I was sitting up at the Clevelander reading a book on the Sun deck, and I looked down, and that happened. And I honestly had to check if it was a verified account because I didn't know, like, that was actually going on. I sent a couple of replies, and then I got the call, and the call to my agent said, are you aware of what's going on Twitter right now? And so my agent called me, and my reply to my agent was, you want me to leave him alone? And they said, yes, we'd like you to leave him alone. And I said, okay, and I kept it moving because we were arguing a point. And I think that the thing that made people, I think, a little nervous about that was that it was a point that was based on religion.
Right.
But we were arguing a point, and I don't – Colin has gone on his show and taken chops of things that I said on television and then made segments out of them. And that was fine. I didn't really have a problem with that. So my assumption on those sorts of things is if somebody is allowed to do that, then I'm allowed to go back and forth with that person on Twitter about something. Like, we can talk about it. We can have a back and forth about it. There's nothing that I say on the air that I am not willing to talk about with somebody, whether they work at ESPN or not. So I've not had a problem. And the back and forth I've had with people on ESPN about stuff are not personal. You know, it doesn't get into who anybody is or anything like that. It's about the point that's being argued. And the one I had with Chris, I think people got so charged up about it because it was about sex. But, I mean, it was ultimately a very respectful back and forth. It didn't even last very long.
All right, let me ask about one that's involving a non-ESPN person, because this is somebody that I've gone back and forth with on Twitter, Clay Travis of Fox. This ain't going to be any surprise. I'm not professionally a fan of the guy. I think personally he comes off like a nice guy. I know people who really like him at Fox. But I think when, you know, you're playing to, you know, you're writing stuff about dumb college football fan bases, to me that's the ultimate low-rent kind of play. Fox knows this, but it's profitable. It's easy to monetize. Everybody who's sort of intelligent gets the con. So I used to battle with him a lot on Twitter, and I'm sure he's not the biggest fan of mine. He probably thinks I'm a moralist or an asshole or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But the one time we really got heated, he reached out to me, and I appreciated this because I think both of us were doing stuff that was more performance art than an actual argument. And I think we were essentially acting for a crowd. And that, to me, or at least I can only speak for myself, that sort of was that bothered me that I'd be doing that. Because, one, I'm not sure how authentic that is. And, two, then you're really not even about the argument itself. You're nothing more than an actor. So I wonder for you, because you've gotten into it both with Clay and other people, are you consciously thinking of the larger context of what's going on, or are you so in the moment with the actual debate that you're just focused on the debate?
Yeah, I'm really just talking about what's going on there. Because one thing I don't really get into too much, like I'll ridicule you in front of everybody, but I do not argue for performance. I don't enjoy arguing for sport in that way. There's some people that are like, okay, we're going to talk about something. Well, I'm going to just pick a side and I'm going to ride it out. That gets on my nerves like nobody's business. Like, I'm not that guy. I'm not the one to really, that's at least the way that I look at it. I'm sure some other people look at it and think I'm just looking for attention, and I can't blame them. I can understand how they could possibly reach such a conclusion. But for me, with those things now, like, we're talking about this now, because the thing is, once it's over, it's going to be over, especially the pace at which social media moves.
True.
Those things are over so fast that it goes, and it's kind of from there. The part, what I do worry is when it becomes clear that once a discussion is started, and now people are out here picking sides, right? And it's like, oh man, we got a fight out here, like it's a high school cafeteria or something like that. That's when I'm more likely to be like, all right, let's step away from this.
How far can you go discussing politics or social issues on your Twitter feed, you think, before you cross whatever the imaginary line is?
That's a good question. I'm not sure because it's never come up. When I took this job, I did have a question as to whether or not something was going to happen with my feed, and that nothing's changed. No one's ever said a word to me about it. I am followed by a great number of ESPN accounts. I am pretty well surveilled. They're making sure I'm not going to nothing's going to happen that's going to mess up anybody's money. But how far into politics is a good question, because I feel like I don't really go into politics. I think that politics is an overused term for things that people might disagree about, right? Like, I'm not going to get into who you should vote for. I'm not going to talk about who you did vote for or anything like that. But what I've done forever has been about the larger public space, like sports and the interplay with all this other stuff. But the other stuff that's there, like the people who are running for president, are public figures. So if there's something funny that's going on with somebody that's running for president, then that's something that I'm going to talk about. The way that I'm going to talk about it, though, is not in the context of who you should or should not vote for. Like, those are the things that I kind of stay out of. But past that, I believe that if I say something that has a legitimate intellectual grounding and it's something that makes sense, I don't think I'm going to wind up having any problem with it. And maybe the day will come where I do wind up having a problem with it, but I've never shied away from talking about things that are controversial on any sort of level, and I've not had any problems thus far.
I got two more for you on Twitter. One time talking to Keith Olbermann, he told me that one of the reasons he likes to go back and forth with people, and sometimes this would even be people with very few followers, not even like a real ID, he called it batting practice, and he said it sharpened him up for his evening show. Is there any part of you that likes the interaction, that likes the back and forth, because you think it sharpens you for your television job or your radio job?
Well, part of the back and forth for me is just kind of speed chess. I'm good at it, I think, right? And so it's like, I feel like on those sorts of things, it's kind of like the guy that's in the park playing chess with five people. Like, I feel like I can play chess with this guy, go hit the button, and then go make a move on another table and then keep it moving. Like, I suppose that there's a certain level of sport that comes from it. But the reason I go back and forth with those people is I know enough about this world to know that just because that guy has 18 followers doesn't mean that he's not representative of something larger. Like,
that's
a significant
fair.
Number of the people who are on Twitter have a small number of followers. So the idea that, why are you wasting your time with someone that no one is listening to? Because those people matter too. And not only do those people matter, there are a lot of people out there who agree with them but are far too sophisticated to say that sort of thing out loud. And so, like, part of why, like, Clay Travis is actually an interesting guy to bring up, similar to that point. So Clay wrote that column about the Confederate flag. Now, if you go through and read that column about the Confederate flag, guess who's agreeing with that column? Dudes with 18 followers. Lots of dudes with 18 followers. Now, the people with 25,000 followers are not going to be the ones to reply to me and to say how much they love that column. They're not going to do that. They understand the reasons why you don't go out there and you don't be that guy. But when it's time to make important decisions, in those times where I'm not around, they're still riding with the same logic. So when I'm coming at these people who are quote-unquote irrelevant or whatever it is, all those people who agree with them, I'll take their logic, I'll give a reply to their logic, and you don't even have to say anything to me about it. It's right there directly for you to deal with. So I get why people have this idea that if you talk on Twitter to people who don't have a whole lot of followers, that you're giving them the quote-unquote attention that they want, and that somehow you are validating their existence by replying to them. They don't want the attention they're about to get from me. Like, I know they don't want the attention they're about to get from me. They delete all the stuff that they said me and I light them on fire for. But there are a whole lot of other people out there who agree with them, and they're lurking silently. Hell, some of them are probably my friends. Well, now they can get me.
That gives you some insight into how Bomani looks at Twitter. One last thing, Bomani. What's your policy on blocking people?
If I don't feel like hearing from you anymore, I block you. I don't need a good reason. Like, I think people think blocking folks on Twitter a little bit too seriously. Following me on Twitter is not some great privilege. It's not some honor that you receive and that I have snatched away from you. I'm just not that important. So if I don't feel like hearing your noise anymore, I'm getting you out of here. That's it.
All right. We're going to finish up with a couple of quick ones here. Why don't I see you writing on ESPN.com right now?
Part of why you don't see me writing on ESPN.com is my bandwidth is a little bit stretched right now, and I don't have that much time. Another part of why you don't see me writing that much is that I have a very, shall we say, awkward relationship with the written word, which is I wrote professionally for a while. I had a job where I wrote pretty much, you know, that was my job for 2 years where all I did was write. I had a one-year contract at ESPN from 2006 to 2007 where I wrote for Page Two. And I came out of that year of working for Page Two with my confidence, after being fired, with my confidence as a writer being really battered. And I am perfectly aware of the fact that I can write very good things. I enjoy writing things more simply when I feel about them, just feel like writing about them, not on command necessarily. But I readily admit that I do not enjoy writing in the way that I used to. And part of that is I don't have the confidence as a writer. Like, I have the intellectual understanding that I'm pretty good at writing, but I don't really have the confidence as a writer that I had when I was 25, 26, 27 years old. I can go back and look at things that I wrote them, and I can look at them and say, wow, you know what? This is better than I remembered, or wow, this is better than that editor told me that it was. But it's something that I need to shake. Dan and I have talked about it for a while, and Dan's made all kinds of suggestions of things that I could do to kind of improve that, or, you know, to get back into it. But it's been something that I've been kind of fighting and trying to deal with now, really, I guess now for the better part of the last 8 years or so. It's something I got to get past. And I think Dan is correct when he talks about the fact that there's a certain permanence to writing. And when you write something that is very, very good, that it sticks around. But like I read stuff, like I reread a Ta-Nehisi Coates book the other day when I got finished. And I was, after that, I started reading one of James Baldwin's books. And I start reading, and I go through that. And I'm just like, man, I wish I could do that. It's possible that I might be able to, but it's tough for me at times. But it's time for me to sit down and write to enjoy the process of writing, because I don't always feel when I'm doing it like I'm doing something well.
If and when The Undefeated launches, would you be interested in writing for them?
I would. It would kind of depend on what the circumstance is. Like, I don't work. I've come to understand and acknowledge I don't work well writing on a schedule. Now, when I first started this contract with ESPN and they had to deal with the Shadow League, I wrote once a week for the Shadow League. You can go look at it. The stuff's good, but the stuff's not great. And part of why the stuff wasn't great was my time would be really cramped, and it would be like, okay, Tuesday afternoon, I got 4 hours. Let me go write this column right fast. But with The Undefeated, I want The Undefeated to do well. Like, I think it is very, very important for a number of reasons for The Undefeated to do well. And if me writing for The Undefeated occasionally can help The Undefeated do well, I'd love to talk to some people about figuring a way to make that work. I talked to them before about doing a video idea, and maybe that works, you know, and maybe that will be the contribution that I wind up making. But there will never be a time where I never write. That being said, I don't have any idea the last time I opened a word processor to write something 850 to 1,000 words.
Who do you consider your closest ally at ESPN and why?
That's a good question. I guess at this point I would say that it would probably be Dan and Eric, and because those are the people that I work with. Now, the thing I think that gets lost and forgotten about working at ESPN is that ESPN is a ginormous place. There are a lot of people in Bristol who have never met me, never talked to me, don't really know that much about me. When I signed the contract in 2013, I would make the argument probably that most people up there didn't really know that much about me or what it was that I had to contribute or to offer to the process. But I think Eric and Dan have been as supportive as anybody. Aaron Solomon also, who I think often we talk a lot about Eric because of PTI, but Aaron does a great job with Around the Horn. And I think that he and Tony kind of get forgotten in the grand scheme on that one. And I think those are probably the guys that I've got right now. There's probably more people that I, you know, need to know, and there's probably some people who really like me that I don't really necessarily know that well. But the guys that I work with on a daily basis are going to be the guys who I'd say probably have my back more than anybody else does.
That's a nice shout out to Aaron Solomon, the one of the head producers of Around the Horn, and a big fan of mine, Bomani. I know he loves me. He's got a big
yeah, but you can't blame Aaron for that, though. You're real hard on Around the Horn.
I have been on. That'd be another podcast we'll do. That's true. I will say that saying it should be played in a North Korean prison was a little bit too harsh. I feel like maybe that went over the line a little bit. The show's better, well, though, as I've written. It's gotten smarter, better people on it, and that is a good thing. All right, here, Bomani, we will finish up on a positive, happy note. Where do you hope to be 5 years from now, professionally?
Just doing something that I like to do. I have been very fortunate the last 5 years that I have been able to work on projects that offered me a level of autonomy to do the things that I wanted to do, while also making a comfortable living while doing it. Like, I've hosted a national satellite radio show. When I worked with SB Nation, I got to write and I got to work on a YouTube show. That was a project I really had a great time doing, and I learned a whole lot from in doing that. And it prepared me very well for what, you know, I'm doing right now and what this has become. But in 5 years, I don't know. I guess I'd like to still be doing radio. I think that would be a good thing. I figure I'd be doing television somewhere, but understand, this job that I have right now is the first time that I've ever had a job for two consecutive years. Like, I'm in the beginning of the third year of this job that I've had. I've never had a job that long. Like, I don't even know how to look that far down the line, because if it ain't been one thing, it's been another. Radio station going out of business, radio station getting sold, grant money runs out, whatever it is. That's what it's always been. So I don't think nearly as much about where I want to be in 5 years as much as if something comes up in 5 years, I'll be ready to make the transition and to make that move as seamlessly as possible to go into it.
The ESPN commentator, Bomani Jones, has been the guest on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast. You can see him on a number of platforms, including he is the co-host of the ESPN show Highly Questionable. He's also the host of the ESPN radio show The Right Time with Bomani Jones. That's weekdays on ESPN, 9 to 11 p.m. Could be at a different time depending on your market. And with all this shaking out now at ESPN Radio, we will see where Bomani might land, whether he lands in the coward spot, whether he moves up a little bit in the day part, whether he stays. He's an interesting, bright guy, and this podcast certainly wishes him the best. Bomani, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Richard. I really appreciate it.
Okay, back in the studio, our thanks to Bomani Jones. That was an excellent interview, as I expected. You're looking for interesting, authentic, honest people, and that's what Bomani was. From talking about the subject of race in sports talk radio, both on the employment side and the discussion, to Twitter, to how he feels about the 10-to-1 slot and why he thinks that's the best slot in radio today. I will say this, one of my first jobs was co-hosting a daily sports talk show in Buffalo, a very big station, 50,000 watt station, made $50 a week, essentially because my partner, who was the sports director, took it pity on me as a very, very poor 21-year-old to green light me some money. But that was one of my favorite jobs. And I would have stayed in radio as a long-term profession, but I just saw the road in front of me very, very hard to go from market to market, city to city. So I admire anybody who does it, and I certainly admire anybody young who does it. But Bomani Jones was a really interesting guest. I've been wanting, I had a sort of a list of like 25 people I wanted as my initial 25. He was on it. So I appreciate his time. Before we get out of here, let me give you some quick thoughts about the Bill Simmons HBO news. That broke after we taped this. Bill Simmons heading to HBO. He will do a talk show weekly in 2016. Has a development deal as well. We'll be doing video podcasts. It's an excellent home for him. I mean, listen, HBO, I don't have to tell anybody this, whether it's John Oliver
whether it's Game of Thrones, you're going back to The Wire, The Sopranos, creative freedom, their rules. They really treat their artists and their talent like creative people. They give them a freedom, and I think that's what Simmons certainly is looking for. They're not going to be ratings challenged. It's not ESPN or Fox. You know, HBO is a subscription service, so they're looking for Bill to put on an interesting, talked-about show. That's essentially going to be his charter. So I think for his purposes, and obviously he'll be a consultant on documentaries, my sense is they'll probably try to get a smaller version of 30 for 30 going. HBO at one time was the dominant sports documentary place in on television, and I think Simmons loves the challenge, my guess would be, of trying to duplicate what some very smart people and he did at ESPN. So it makes sense for Bill. I have no idea if the show is going to be good. I think Bill's good on television. Do I think he's great? No. But I think if you have great producers with you and a great concept, I think you could put on great television. You know, the thing that at HBO, people like John Oliver, et cetera, is they're great performers, and that's why they're great on television. Bill has kind of a different television skill set. But as we saw on his podcast, where I think he's terrific, he's a good interviewer. He gets good people. He's creative. He listens. And I think he'll have a shot. As for where he'll end up writing-wise, that's still the big question to be determined. All of us are certainly, those of us who cover this space are working on that hard. I cannot tell you how many times I've reached out to Simmons and his people over the last couple months. To their credit, they have stayed on point, and relatively speaking, they have stayed silent. We love hearing from listeners. Please get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Richard Deitch, RichardDeitsch. It's at my name. Send us any suggestions for future guests or questions you would like answered. If you like the show, please share it with your friends. The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud. We have it as well. We're getting some great technical help from my man Dan Bloom at Panoply, and the producer of this podcast, as always, is the great Bette Marsden. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.